We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management archaeology and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 189 for May 6th, 2020. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about a hypothetical future for cultural resources management. So get out your best apocalypse books and start thinking about ideas because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Doug in Scotland.
Hello.
Heather in California.
Hi there.
And Stephen in Calgary.
Hello.
So, guys, it's as we've been mentioning every time we record during this crazy 2020 lockdown phase, it is Sunday, April 26th, as we're recording this. These usually come out about a week and a half. We usually record these about a week and a half before they release. So, but just for anybody listening to this in the future, as I mentioned before, I like to put out the date because things are changing so rapidly. I don't want you to think that we're out of touch if something wacky happens in the 9 days between recording this and posting this that we didn't talk about because we didn't know about it. So the world could change massively in that amount of time. That's how quickly things are changing right now. So keeping that in mind, before we started recording, there was a little discussion going on about whether or not the virus COVID-19 or coronavirus more broadly was actually causing any disruptions or anything in CRM for anyone, like really knowing somebody that was sick or, you know, infected a crew or something like that. And I gotta say, not only that, and trust me, I'm not any sort of denier or anything. I think this is really bad. I see the numbers every day because of this thing I've got with my other company, a safety company. So we see all these crazy, horrible, scary numbers. But luckily so far for me, I don't know a single person or family member that this doesn't mean there aren't any. I just don't know about it, but that actually has either tested positive or has this, with the one possible exception being my brother-in-law, who is a physician's assistant over at Mount Sinai Hospital, one of the Sinai hospitals in Manhattan. And he went home sick, you know, chest pains, things like that. It was mild. He said he probably had a more mild version of it, not version, but mild symptoms, I guess. But he hadn't been tested last time we talked to him. And that was about a week ago and haven't heard from him since, which means he's probably okay. So that's as close as I have come to brushing up against this thing myself. And given the percentages in the country, I'm willing to bet most people, unless you have a massive circle of friends and family that you know about, you know, just statistically probably aren't going to know too many people, if any, that actually have this. But, you know, that being said, it is affecting some people. So
my initial question was whether or not we had, you know, heard of anybody in the field. I was really curious because I know our company is working very hard to implement these field protocols. We change them on a weekly basis and have a, you know, all hands meeting every week. And I was curious to see, you know, if this had been, if there had been an outbreak or something for CRM that has affected fields. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, personally, I know multiple people that have caught it and lost their lives, but they were all, I lost my mother-in-law about a week and a half ago. But she was 90, and then her aunt, kind of was like a sister, my husband's aunt, she died just a few days before that. She was 96. And then an uncle of his also died, but they were all in nursing homes. And so I think, you know, when you look at it, the average age is 80. That's pretty astounding when you think about it. I don't know if it's moved a few years here and there, but the last I heard, the standard age or the average age was 80. That's pretty high. So that means you have even older people like my mother-in-law and her aunt. And so I have, but they're all on the East Coast. So that also makes a difference. So I haven't met anybody out here. Yeah.
the bigger population centers and the target population for this, actually. But I did see an article just the other day, I think it was still in my news feed today, on my Apple News thing, that said that some younger people in their 20s and 30s are getting coronavirus, but not getting some of the symptoms, but are having strokes because of it.
I saw that.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
I wonder, though, there's so much crazy stuff going on right now as far as stories. I don't even know what to believe anymore. Sure. So I do need to look at that deeper.
Well, I will say, just before we get to Doug, I will say one comment on, you know, this affecting the field and you asking about that. I think one of the things that's great, but we also need to be careful of is those of us on this call, I mean, obviously people have probably heard of something, but those of us on this call have not heard of much of an interruption in field work or anything like that. As far as interruption related to people getting the virus, obviously there's an interruption in field work because of no work going on in some places. But as far as people actually getting sick in the field and infecting other people, we haven't heard of that. And I wanted to say, you know, one reason is, Heather, companies like yours actually really being conscious of this thing and changing your policies and procedures with updated and new information. And that is amazing. The reason you're not seeing anything is because you're doing the right thing. But then just like some of the southern states that we're seeing this week and this last week and this coming week, trying to reduce their or trying to open businesses back up and doing things, they have felt that comfort as well. Hey, nothing's really going on, so let's go back to normal. And that's where, you know, you got to be like, no, we actually have to keep these procedures in place until well after we think it's normal, until well after we think that we can start relaxing our standards. And I don't know what your company's policy is, but I'll tell you what, if I were running that sort of operation, as long as it's not, you know, a huge financial burden and a huge hindrance on us, you know, doing this, even if California opened everything back up in 30 days and said, we're great, let's do this thing, there's no reason not to just continue those procedures for another month or so, just because.
Absolutely. That is our approach. Yeah. That is definitely our approach. Yeah. I actually think there's some really good aspects, and we've talked about this on other podcasts, that have come as a result of this highly conscious way of doing things. And I actually think that there are some excellent results or silver lining to this. That is, we're more organized, we're more digital, and we are now a lot cleaner. It's so nice to get the trucks back and they're not absolutely trashed. I mean, if nothing else, that's, I don't know if you guys ever have to share with other, you know, like biologists or whatever, but it is, they notoriously return them extremely dirty, and so do cultural people. And now they're nice and clean, because that's a big pet peeve of mine. But anyway, I'll let Doug say his thing. Sorry, Doug.
Yeah, Doug, go ahead.
No, it was just a comment. Like, Chris, that would be the normal experience, because in the part where you didn't know many people, and then Heather's known quite a few, because it's not a random distribution across the world. Mm. There was some really good data that came out of South Korea when it first kicked off, where they actually did proper contact tracing of people and stuff. And like it moves along networks of people. So if you know one person who's got it, likely it then means that all their families got it and their contacts as well. And so it tends to hit social circles. Mm. And so then you'd actually know quite a few people. And yeah, so if it hasn't hit your social circle yet, you're not going to actually know probably anyone. So that sounds exactly normal. And unfortunately, that then feeds into people, as you were talking about, like wanting to start back up, because they're like, well, I don't know anyone who's been affected. And then, of course, you just have to add that yet. You don't know anyone yet, but it's killed so many people for only infecting maybe 1% of the population, 1 to 2, and that's, you know, killed more people in the Vietnam War. So, when it starts to get like 10 or 20% of the population, everyone will know someone who's died.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, let's move on to some other topics here. And as we were, you know, thinking about what we were going to do for this, Doug actually came up with an interesting idea for an episode, a somewhat of a hypothetical scenario. So, Doug, why don't you go ahead and just kick off your idea here. I could just read what you wrote, but since you're on the show, why don't you just tell us what you're thinking?
Do you have it in front of you? Because I vaguely remember. I'm probably not going to say it correctly. Yeah, it'd probably be better if you read it off, and then I can take it from there. Because I can't remember my exact wording. I'm pretty sure I'm going to mess it up now that you've asked for me to say it on law. Yeah.
All right. So I'll go ahead and just read what you wrote here. So he says, hypothetical scenario. It is the year 2030. A cataclysmic event has destroyed most of the country, and now we are rebuilding our society. As one of the few remaining archaeologists, the new government has tasked you with rebuilding CRM. New laws, new methods, anything goes. How would you do it? I'd like some clarification, though, as mm-hmm. I toss it over to you, Doug, because how was the world destroyed? Was it nuclear weapons? Was it a war? So are things actually destroyed, or was it something more like a virus and most of the infrastructure is still basically intact and it's basically just people that are gone? And was it just our country, or was it the entire world? Is this something we're concerned with? So, you'll have to expand on this a little bit. I need more details.
Yeah. So originally written like it's 2021, the country's like collapsed.
Right. And
yeah, but I felt like that hits a little too close to home at the moment.
Too soon.
Well, maybe it won't be. We might be looking at 2021, and a good portion of the population has died off, and there's been a big election, and a completely new government is in. Without the required 2/3 majority to change things. And so there's maybe the opportunity to rewrite some laws. So let's go with that scenario that, let's just say there's been a new election and there's no longer the worry of filibustering in the Senate. But this one, the people in charge of the government now has now asked, is there a better way to do CRM? And if so, how would you do it? Nothing's off the table.
I'll give it a shot first off, because I think when I think of cataclysmic event and you say most of the country has been destroyed, I'm going to, again, my thinking goes to people in that case. So our population has been drastically reduced. Let's say 70%, something huge, a really big number. I would wonder personally, because let's say it's also some sort of virus related thing. A lot of our politicians, just because of the nature of politics and the fact that when you get up, higher up in the politics, like even Senate and governors and, Congress people, those are typically not all the time, and growing numbers are younger these days, but typically older people. So it is a good possibility that a lot of them were taken out from these higher up government positions. And if this happens quick enough, it's going to be difficult to replace them and recover from that. And I would wonder about the future of the United States as a country in that circumstance, if we did lose that many people, and whether or not the federal government would be, quote, put on hold and in favor of more regional governing, not necessarily even states, but maybe even new lines being drawn, something like that. So I think if we were concerned with CRM laws in that case, which I'll tell you what, it took us a few hundred years as a country before we were concerned with cultural laws. But I think as far as cultural laws and preserving the past and preserving heritage goes, it would more come down to probably like what it was in the beginning, where people were more concerned with, and honestly now too, you look at National Register nominations, nobody nominates things that they want because, hey, this is just good for the world. No, it's important to them. It's important to them or their family or their cultural area, and they try to make a national case out of it, or at least a state case to get on some state register, because that's the only way to protect it. But realistically, it's important to them. It's important to a very small group of people, and they try to persuade everyone else that, no, this actually has broader significance. And if they make that case, then that works. And I don't think it would be any different if we were to rewrite the laws, because this entire industry is basically built on passion. It's based on a passion for history and preserving your past and your heritage. And that's human nature. And I don't think that's going to go away. And as long as there's somebody alive that wants to fight that fight, then we'll have the laws. And I think it would end up being virtually like it is now. I don't think a whole lot would change, to be honest. If there were different people in government, maybe they would be a little more strict. Maybe we'd have a little more power as far as CRM goes related to construction and development. But I don't know. That's kind of where I'm at on a first thought on this.
Okay, so I should say, like, the cataclysmic event is just sort of more of a mind trick thing. It's more to think of as if you, so you should maybe think of it as you can do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do? And it's meant to sort of push us past what we currently do, but maybe it is. Maybe, as you said, you would choose to do basically everything as it is now in the future. But it's thinking more about, like, you know, if you could change things, how would you change it? And if there's no barriers to changing. So this is just like a more pie in the sky, not necessarily.
Sure.
You know, obviously no cultural heritage law is going to be passed, I don't know, in the foreseeable future, unless, of course, there is some mm-hmm. sort of catastrophic event that suddenly changes everything dramatically. But it's thinking about, like, putting a vision forward for CRM in the future, because if eventually that future does arrive, you want to have a plan instead of being reactive. So it is thinking, sure. like, you know, what would your ideal situation be if you could do anything?
I kind of was approaching it more from a practical sense. And so it's my reaction is a little more pedestrian, not as interesting or creative, really. It's just based on my pet peeves, like requiring that site records be actually created after somebody does work. Like, not that it's just an ethical thing that people should do, but that it's part of the structure of when, let's see, an agency is giving the go ahead, let's say on an RFP, or is what they're requiring in the environmental process, that a site record absolutely must be done. I know that sometimes that happens, but I think it should be across the board, because what's the, you know, what's the purpose? I would say more often than not, I go to a site record, and the last time anything was written on a site that is well known is 1929, or, you know, that's in the Santa Barbara area, because we have a very prolific and well-respected archaeologist named David Banks Rogers, who wrote a book in 1929, and it's still kind of the go-to, which is sad when you think about it for some sites. So that would be one thing. And then the other would be to really organize our nomenclature and to have forms that are filled out based on that nomenclature, and that everybody has an understanding of it, because I think it would make mm-hmm. us a lot more effective as archaeologists to really understand what that person is saying, because we're all speaking from the same point of view. Not obviously we don't all have the same point of view, but at least if we have some set nomenclature, I think that's one thing that really dogs our discipline. And so, again, I told you it's very simple, but it is based on, and I have a few others, but there's two yeah. for you.
Okay. Well, hey, on that note, let's take it to break. And then we're going to keep talking about this, obviously, on the other side of the break, because that spawns some things I want to say, too. So we'll be back in just a second. Stand by.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code CRMARC. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to episode 189 of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. And, you know, we're always talking about how we're in the apocalypse. So now we're talking about somewhat of an apocalypse scenario in certain ways. And it's interesting, I think even more interesting, realizing that like everybody on this call kind of thought about Doug's question or scenario in a slightly different way. That's also somewhat of an interesting thought. But Heather, something you were saying about nomenclature at the end of the segment one, I'll tell you what, that is, you hit the nail on the head right there. I think that would change everything if we had somewhat of a national or federal nomenclature and recording system, because, you know, when this whole entire field was conceived of, not just CRM, but archaeology in the United States, you know, it was, again, really more passion projects of people working locally and regionally and coming up with ways to record stuff in their area. And it just turned into, you know, when NHPA came around and NEPA, and nobody really had any local forms, and there wasn't any federal guidance coming down the line. So everybody just kind of decided how they were going to record stuff in their own local area. And it's been going on for, you know, 5 or 6 decades now. And a lot of people think, hey, this is how you do archaeology. I don't know how many people I've talked to in CRM that haven't traveled around the country, that have only been in one area their entire career. And they're floored that you actually do things differently in other places, even in a state right next door to them, and they just don't understand it. So, you know, with us having things like the National Historic Preservation Act, the National Register of Historic Places, why don't we have a national system of recording archaeological sites? You know, it just doesn't make any sense to me that 2020 and we still don't have that, and we don't have any concern from the federal government for putting something like that into place. So that would be my one big, you hit the nail on the head, go to for rewriting the laws, is let's do something like that. I think it would change everything. So, all right. And Stephen, you mentioned during the break that you have some completely different thoughts about all this. What's going on in your crazy brand new Canadian head?
Well, it's still an American head. It's just an expat American head. And I appreciate that the question stated that the country was destroyed. So I'm assuming everything's okay in Canada and I can just sit back and sip some tea and watch the chaos from afar. But
that's right.
I didn't mention which country. I specifically did not mention any country. You could, you know,
that's okay. Canada's options.
Canada's been due for a cataclysmic event for a long time now. So,
you know, I think worthless oil is it. So it's,
yeah,
it's pretty grim. Well, to start off, because kind of in the break, in the first segment, but also in the break, we were discussing like the nature of the apocalypse and you know, what exactly is this? And in my mind, it was a lot more of what's called the jackpot in the last couple of books written by William Gibson, where it's not any one event. It is basically death by a thousand cuts, where, you know, there's pandemics and economic fallout and, you know, natural disasters and, you know, corruption, and it all just kind of crumbles society, you know, just slowly takes it apart, and all that's left is a very small population of humans and largely controlled by what's called the Klept, which is basically rich criminals, I guess, is the best way to putting it. Mm-hmm. So it's a dark and kind of believable perspective of like what the apocalypse could actually be like, and like real time believable, because we're all sitting in our respective homes, you know, hiding from a virus. So, and I'll be honest, I don't have a unified program of cultural resources in mind, because I only had a few hours to think about this. So some of the thoughts in my mind are completely different than what you guys are talking about, where we basically clean up the existing system. In my mind, the existing system is gone. Like it's mm-hmm. like nobody's doing archaeology the way that we currently do archaeology. Nobody is like the idea of going and cataloging culture history is a dead idea. It died out with the apocalypse.
It's a luxury, maybe, in a way.
Yeah, or you could go the full like anime version, where it's like, you know, just some crackpot who's going around documenting stuff because they somehow think it's going to bring order to, you know, the chaos of the universe. But yeah, it goes back you know, that aspect, the cultural historical stuff, kind of goes back to being an avocationalist thing. It's something that people who have some sort of passion and wherewithal are kind of doing it on their own accord. It wouldn't necessarily be tied in with cultural resources management, where that would be a lot more tied into for the, you know, National Register, for example. It'd be a lot tied closer to the ideas of your first two criteria, where those are very much tied to the identity of communities and groups of people. And so in that sense, there would be sort of a, I just kind of wrote down in my notes, kind of the desire path strategy of urban planning. So be like a desire path sort of strategy of cultural resources, where it's kind of like, you know, you put it out there and people will gravitate towards what they actually want to preserve, or what are the meaningful aspects of past history for them. And the archaeologist's role in that would be, you know, like, okay, well, what don't you know? What do you want to know? And, you know, how can we help? Like, you know, we've got the toolkits. You've got the questions. You know, we go in and we start working towards that sets of criteria that set of questions. I have kind of a problem with that in that, you know, with the notion of like archaeology is about giving a voice to the voiceless. You are definitely dominating the past with the people of the who have survived, which in you know the post jackpot phase is people who are essentially Trump. So you know, like and they're not going to be concerned about a lot of people who are no longer around.
Yeah.
For actual preservation needs sorts of things, I'm assuming that a lot of infrastructure got hastily demolished, either as, you know, a byproduct of the apocalypse or in humanity's rush to kind of bolster civilization from, you know, the effects of the apocalypse, that a lot of stuff just got demolished. And so I think there would be a lot of kind of virtualized preservation. And I know I'm not a big fan of the idea of this as preservation, like digitization is not preservation, but reconstruction. And one example of that, that's a current example, and I think it's kind of defunct, but I thought it was pretty cool, is there was some sort of web initiative, or they have a website where a group of people were doing photogrammetry of old photographs from 1964 in Tokyo. And I don't know that it got too far. The last update on websites from like 2018, but it was pretty much an interesting initiative because it's Tokyo that doesn't exist anymore. It's a pre-bubble Tokyo. And I could see things like that happening where you start to recreate like immersive simulations of societies as they were pre-jackpot.
I like all those. Very inspiring for more thought, you know, just because our discipline is based on really looking at the past and past life ways, I think it would be a novel and good idea to learn from history and to really make a concerted effort to include everyone. So I think it would take, you know, I know that in an apocalyptic time that you would be really focusing on probably just making sure you eat and that sort of thing. But there's going to be people, there's going to be think tanks, there's going to be people that are going to be sitting around saying, okay, how are we going to move forward here? And there are going to be people that are going to have to, you know, actually step outside the box. I think in a, you know, kind of like a Monument Men type of idea where they saw a need and kind of stepped outside the box and did something that was out of the ordinary, but very important. And thank goodness they did do that. One thing would be for me, you know, there's a lot of things that have been lost, especially with Native American history and understanding, because the way they looked at life was not about material necessarily, you know, owning a certain land or having, you know, structures that are, this is my structure and everything that I am is put into this structure and it means a lot to me and kind of like the built environment. They, you know, they had a different perspective on life and you know, of course, material goods were important to them, but it was just in a different sense. And then they had oral history and thank goodness we had early, you know, early people that decided to actually go around and take account of oral histories. And I'm sure that, you know, obviously there's a lot that we did lose, but at that moment, for us to learn from that mistake of not having done enough of that quicker would be to look around and say, okay, who, let's make sure that we're not just talking about the people that want people to talk about them or that want to write down and make an account of history from this perspective, because this is, these people are fighting for that because it's their perspective, but just to do, to really look and try to look at every aspect of society and making sure that everyone is looked at and considered and accounted for. And, you know, obviously that's an ideal and that is something that I would hope everybody would want to do. But I think that in the apocalyptic time, that would be something that's, that I think would be really important. And you would need a think tank, people that are really making concerted effort to do that. So that's my creative answer, aside from my practical answers.
Well, and I think that ties in a lot because I did, you know, voice the concern about, you know, like giving attention to the voiceless. But I think that now that you mention it, and I hadn't put this on my list, but one of the concepts that I really like are like the concepts of intangible heritage, that, you know, the ways of doing are as important as right. the physical byproducts of it. And yeah. I think that that could, again, come to the forefront where we're not talking about, you know, types of projectile points or pottery or something like that. We're talking about like, you know, the way that these things are manufactured and the way that these things right. are used. And, you know, as, yeah, it's the practices that matter, not the stuff.
I think that that's a really good point. And, you know, I think about this a lot when we're looking at, you know, I'm a visual person and when I'm in my head trying to recreate a site, and it's really frustrating when all you see in my, in your eyes, mind's eye picture is, I, the way I visualize is like you have spears that are kind of just like located in different spots in the site. And then you have a milling stone over here and you have a arrowhead, but everything is inanimate. Everything's just laying there. And it's sad to me when the moments, and we've all had them, these moments where we actually have experienced something where we can, we don't know exactly what happened, but we have a pretty good idea of a one moment in time of exactly. And sometimes it's that most minute thing. Like, you know, when early in my career, we came across a pile of debitage and there was a boulder. It was like an awesome, just a perfect good sized boulder to sit on. It was nice and flat and it wasn't craggy or anything. It was comfortable to sit at. And there was a pile of debitage on one side and a couple broken arrowheads on the other and like blanks actually that were broken. And it, there was like that one moment of time that just took me back to this guy sitting, somebody, an individual sitting here and he's working away and he breaks this blank that he's been working on for a while and he gets upset and throws it over his behind him. Right. And, you know, it's such a, it seems like an unimportant moment when in fact it's one of the, it's an important moment because it actually brought all those pieces. It brought the pile, it brought the blanks, it brought the broken blanks, it brought the half-made projectile point. It brought them all to life. It took them from the ground and it brought them up in the air, moving around. And so to me, I think the closer that we can get to that place as an archaeologist of telling that story or making it, not telling the story actually, because we don't want, we're not telling somebody else's story, but to bring these artifacts to life, to be able to look at archaeology from another perspective and really rethink how we do things so that we can make these artifacts come to life and that they are more than just a byproduct, that we're learning about the people that made them. That would be awesome and would take a lot of smart people in one room in some hole in the ground after an apocalyptic event. And they have no time but to think about how to make this happen.
So you guys are a bit bleak on your post-apocalyptic, but I want to push back on one of the parts we mentioned earlier about, like, you know, archaeology would suddenly become everything's based on survival, and somehow archaeology or the past would be seen as not an essential thing. I guess, yeah, possibly, you know, pulling out 1 by 1 meter squares and, you know, measuring things down might not be essential, but I would say the past is pretty much an essential aspect of culture. And you can look at it across any place, any time. What's the oldest museum? Was in Babylon, but not like biblical Babylon, like back in Sumerian. So, you know, you have museums that are 4,000 years old. The first ones you have, I was remembering when I did my field school down in Belize, the Mayan, when they'd move bodies. So they'd re-excavate their relatives and, you know, rebundle them up and put them down. And then what is it? A lot of the Andean cultures, you still have mummies and there's that connection. Attila the Hun had the whole thing about finding an old sword, and it was the Sword of Mars. The Romans rebuilt a lot of the old Greek buildings, and not new ones, but like reconstructed the old ones to go back to the value of wherever the Greek civilization was before them. And I mean,
but you don't think we've lost that, Doug? We don't think, I'm not saying that that is the way it should be. My point is that we have lost that. A lot of people in this society look at history and archaeology as a luxury. And my point is that we shouldn't. It's important. I'm exactly what you're saying, Doug. But unfortunately, the reality is I would like to see that in an apocalyptic time that we would sit back and go, whoa, okay, now we really do. Let's do this right this time. And let's understand that, you know, mm-hmm. We got ourselves into this situation because we didn't study history, and we didn't really consider how there's patterns, and we keep making the same mistakes. Do you think, Doug? I mean, I believe that there's a lot of people that believe that history and archaeology specifically, because that's our discipline, is a luxury. It shouldn't be that way, but I think a lot of people do feel it's that way.
We could probably discuss this in the next segment, but I would say everyone values what we're describing, but in a sense, historians and archaeologists, and in a sense, you know, CRM is cultural resource management. It's dominated by archaeology, but it shouldn't be. Is that we have moved it into such a space that we are not actually capturing or dealing with what people think is important and not essential. So I know this is going to be controversial, but I would say a lot of how we do it now kills a lot of what makes it essential to people.
Yep.
Totally. And so how we define it and how we work in it makes it almost seem like a luxury, mm-hmm. when in fact it is essential to any culture anywhere. I haven't met a culture or a person or anyone who isn't concerned about where they've been, and where they're going. But I would say how we operate now does not capture that.
Okay. That's a good place to stop for this segment. Let's pick it up and wrap this up on the other side. Back in a second. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 189. I think it's the apocalypse version, episode 50, whatever it is. I don't know, but we're constantly talking about apocalypse these days. So Heather and Doug were making some excellent arguments at the end of the last segment and throughout, and Stephen had his hand up, but we couldn't get to him. So Stephen, what is your response to all this?
There's a lot. And now I have to try to remember it all. Yeah, I feel like one of the points that Heather was making is that part of the problem is there are a lot of people today, pre-jackpot, pre-apocalypse, who don't necessarily feel that tied to the past, beyond like personal past, like family history, stuff like that. And even that is, it's the notion of that the past, it's the past is another country sort of thing, where it's, that wasn't us, literally us. And therefore, it doesn't really matter. That the idea that events have historical resonance, like the effects of events continue on through time, doesn't necessarily register or be accepted, because partly because it's hard. Like it's hard to conceive of or to deal with that. That sort of option. Even Doug's question is kind of like that, right? Like it's the, okay, if it was a blank slate, what would you do? And it's like, well, it wouldn't be a blank slate, because there's always the effects of previous events. And in some ways, right, it's wouldn't even be easy to identify for us here, because we don't necessarily, you know, like we spent part of the first segment talking about, like, well, when you say apocalypse, well, what exactly do you mean? Are there still buildings? You know, it's really tough, because it's like, how much of a blank slate is a blank slate?
Yeah.
But that's the same sort of issue, right? Like that's what a lot of people perceive of you know, the past. You know, I'm going to toss out another piece of fiction, because I'm literally just talking with my wife about this morning. It's one of those conversations where we both agree with each other and just keep saying the same thing. There's a book called Lovecraft Country, and in it does an excellent job of talking about theoretically post-segregation Chicago, but at the same time, it's like, well, you know, if you're a black person, you can be in these neighborhoods and don't count on a mortgage. And how these sorts of things set up for people today, right? Like these actions of the past still have repercussions today, and one of the things that we need to deal with, you know, as archaeologists today, let alone, you know, in post-jackpot era, is dealing with the idea that, like, no, the stuff is relevant because the effects of these events are still here, and we're still doing these things. And it's not a matter of like, well, we should know about, you know, necessarily even the small events, like Heather was using to describe the Flint Napper, but like, you know, big events, you know, they continue on. An event isn't just one single point in time. It continues on through time. And we're really bad at convincing others of this.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my ramble.
Okay. So I just was thinking about something as we're all talking about this, and especially as I was just kind of sitting back and listening in the last segment. You know, we're talking about, we originally started this with Doug saying, you know, we're basically starting over. What new laws, new methods, things like that would we come up with? But really, you know, it is all around preservation and really what's important to us as a society to look at, right? And we're talking about new laws in this context, but I think let's just look at, you know, we record stuff that is hundreds and then also tens of thousands of years old, and in some case, way older than that, depending on how far back you want to go with humanity and where you are in the world. And the bigger the world gets for all of us, like the world is, I would venture to say global for pretty much everybody in the in countries like the United States, you know, areas like the UK, things like that, because we have a global news media, we have the internet, you know, we have friends around the world. I mean, we're in three countries on this podcast right now. So, you know, it's generally global the way we're thinking, but the farther back you go, the smaller your quote world is, because you just don't know about things on the outside. You know, it's there, but you just don't care. It's so far away. You have no contact with it. So these catastrophes that Doug has mentioned at the beginning of these have happened many, many, many times in the past. And people have, while they didn't necessarily have laws and regulations around protecting cultural heritage and cultural resources, they must have had something that was either a societal understanding or something like that, because we have buildings over in Europe and other parts of the world that are 1,000 years old, right? So when these things have happened, people have said, yeah, we're going to rebuild that. We're going to keep it going. Look at Notre Dame Cathedral, you know, I mean, that burned down by a fire, but they're rebuilding it now. And I'm willing to bet that it's gone through some stuff before and in its history. And other major structures that we have that are still around, we've decided to preserve those, not just in the past 100 years, but for the past 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years. We've decided well after those things were done being used that they were worth preserving, whether we had the laws for them or not. And I think it's that human attitude that's going to continue, even if the world ends tomorrow and we have to rebuild from scratch.
Yeah, but along those lines, I would say, you know, this is something we should be aiming for, because that's not what we currently do. So if you think about those temples in Japan, so obviously with earthquakes and a lot of stuff being made of wood, and then also just general humidity, bugs, anything, wooden buildings are not going to survive. And so they keep rebuilding the same buildings in Japan. Generation after generation, they rebuild it. But UNESCO does not, or a lot of other definitions of heritage, does not actually recognize that as being world heritage, because it was rebuilt 30 years ago. So to them, it's not, it's a very technical, very dry, sucking the spirit out of what is important to people definition, in that that's not considered cultural heritage or world cultural heritage or important cultural heritage because it's been rebuilt. Whereas, yeah, I think, Chris, you've brought up a great point of, you know, so many things have been rebuilt over the years, and it's rebuilt because it's important. And it's the act of doing that that we should be putting down and considering. And I'd say, like, currently we miss that off in a lot of our cultural resource management regulations and laws, and, like, you know, just buildings as well. Buildings have to be old to be important. And then, you know, you can't, if it gets knocked down, that's it. That's the end of that building. You can't reconstruct it and have that reconstruction be considered, you know, well, potentially could get on the historical registry in, you know, a law, you know, 50 years or something, because it was an important reconstruction, but because it was reconstructed, not because of the importance. But even then, like, criteria D and stuff like that, where how many lithic scatters have we re-recorded and didn't do anything with because we couldn't find a diagnostic lithic point or anything that could date it? I mean, that's still a very important event. You know, these are events that people, that happened in people's lives that were, you know, important landscapes, looking at it very differently. But we've put these really dry, very tick boxy definitions of what is cultural heritage. And so I think what we're talking about is, like, you know, if there is an apocalypse, we probably wouldn't be stuck with criteria D of, you know, and these sort of built up bureaucracies that have come with, just because, you know, no one had known how to put together a law before for cultural heritage. So it's what we ended up with.
Yeah.
But I think, I don't know, maybe we're all in agreement that there would be archaeology in the future. It would look radically different because it would be a different focus on what we consider the past and how we conduct it, I think. I mean, I could be completely misinterpreting what everyone said, so I'll throw it over to you guys to correct me.
Yeah, I like everything that you're saying. I totally agree. I think, you know, this all kind of points to something that's, I think Stephen had said it also, was that, you know, we're just not doing, you know, we're not doing our job in making history important. You know, how many young people in the young, you know, future's in the young people. And if we're not, you know, if it's more of a curiosity and it's only interesting to people as a curiosity, we're just not, those of us that are historians or trying to document past and culture, we're just not doing our job. And I think that one of, it's like twofold in my mind, is that first, we do need to make it relatable. We have to demonstrate its importance in some way. But at the same time, I think a lot of times the reason history is turned off is because people attach agendas to history. And, you know, we're human beings. We do have agendas, of course, but I think we need to be really careful as historians to be as biased or non-biased as possible. And so making history relatable, but at the same time, not attaching agenda, especially with the younger generation now that, you know, and a completely understandable, now I sound like I'm really old, but that the younger generation, I know this just because I live with two of them, is very skeptical of agendas, very skeptical of people's opinions and how they see things, which is great. We want that. We want that questioning. But at the same, so now, because of that, though, we've turned them off in for history in some ways. And I mean, I think we, you know, there when we were young, there were plenty of people that weren't interested in history. But I think there's two things that in a general sense, we need to focus on as historians or documenters of society and life ways in the past. And that is to make past relatable, and but at the same time to not attach our own personal agendas to that. I think even though they seem like simple ideas, they're not that easy to do, which is why we haven't done it yet very successfully.
Right.
I do think that it's worthwhile having a discussion, and maybe not in this show, but maybe in a future show, where is, like, you know, Doug talked about, like, all these things are important. Well, are they? That we are very much in the mode of that, like, all archaeology is, you know, like, all archaeological properties are important to some degree. And you know, but some make the cut and some don't make the cut. And I would counter that with not everything that everybody ever did is important. How we determine that is definitely needs a look at and a revisit, because I don't necessarily agree with some of the ways that we determine that. And I particularly don't like the idea of, like, having to KonMari all the archaeological material of the past. because really, like, who am I to judge this stuff, right? But coming up with a way of dealing with the idea that, like, you know, is our job to document everything that ever happened, or to work with the things that are important to people today? And you know, where the middle ground is between the two, that's a huge discussion.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, on that note, I think we're going to end this. But I think when I have some field work coming up this summer, I am going to try to shoot some video of me saying, looking at this Elko corner notch projectile point, of which we have tens of thousands, and saying, this doesn't spark joy, and then chucking it over my shoulder. But I don't think that would go over very well. Oh, man. You know, and one real quick final comment too, depending on your version of the apocalypse, obviously survival is going to be the name of the game. And that's where most TV shows and movies and things like that go. I mean, they go full apocalypse and it's survival mode after that. But once that's taken care of, you know, there's always somebody that cares about something. And so we'll have somebody doing something that cares about something. And as soon as any sort of government takes place, then there'll be some sort of regulation around that. And as soon as somebody decides, okay, we're going to start building stuff again, and then they just want to build stuff, then that person who cares about things is going to have to get in their way. And they're going to do that with laws. That's how we, that's how we stop people. It's either laws or shotguns. And that's, you know, that's how things go. So I think this was a good topic, good conversation. What do you guys think out there in podcast land that are listening to this? Leave a comment wherever you saw the podcast. Send us an email. Send us an email comment. Let us know if we could use your name or not. Doesn't matter. We just like to hear what you have to say, and maybe we'll talk about it on the air and bring up your ideas, which knowing this crowd will spark an entire new 1 hour long episode. So again, thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
Oh, Jesus. I guess I'll have to leave that in.
Yes.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website, or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye, except for Doug.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.